Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I was so excited by the possibilities offered by this day that I forgot to shave. This indeed is a landmark occasion, and you do me great honor in inviting me to participate. I am, I publicly confess, an actor and a writer. However, I find that that isn't all I am, and sometimes I'm embarrassed even when the generosity behind the introduction is so apparent as it was tonight. I listen once again to the roll call of the films and the television shows that I've been in, and I blush. I said to Ruby, you know, that's really not me, and maybe we shouldn't send out the bios with those lists. Why don't we instead send out the dossiers that the FBI has on our behavior? Instead, surely they would have something to talk about then. The speeches, the marches, the demonstrations. The appearances before committees, you know, the sudden escapes and all those wonderful things. So I took the trouble to acquire from the FBI my document, the dossier. It was heavy, you know, like a phone book. And I looked and I read. It was the dullest. It had none of my great accomplishments. The FBI had spent time and money getting details about the fact that I appeared somewhere and I spoke or I bought this newspaper or I said that. And when it got to one point, it really did make me feel bad. It accused me of being a fellow traveler to Ruby Dee. I mean, that's my wife. I'm supposed to follow her. So I threw that away too. And I stand before you exposed as a man who, in spite of what it says either on the bio or the dossier, I'm still a lover of the human adventure. Freedom is still the most exciting thing I know. And when we get a chance to say something meaningful about those heroes and heroines who've shown us the way so beautifully, I always leap for the chance to join in. Yet I notice in the bio, for example, it doesn't say that at one time I worked in a film called John Brown's Raid, and the film was made at Harper's Ferry, and I played the part of one of John Brown's men. I was Dangerfield Newby. Yes. So at least that should have been in the bio, you know. And there are other things that I might claim to have accomplished more true. Well, let me tell you, for example, that one of the most important things in my life when I was a student down in Waycross, Georgia, was that every year in February we would have what we call Negro History Week. And we students were required to spend 51 weeks of every year preparing for Negro History Week. And part of my job was to memorize some of these magnificent words of black people who had accomplished things. And certainly the words of Frederick Douglass were some of the first that struck across my mind and my imagination. And I have tried to be influenced by that man, by his thoughts, by his words, and by the way he expressed himself, and it has led me here directly tonight. This has been so far a wonderful occasion. I think John Brown and Frederick Douglass both would smile to see us here and join in these festivities, because the truth is, John Brown still lives. Now, the FBI, not knowing who John Brown is, but still having some interest in my behavior, will possibly report this incident back to the, and say, hey, we got another one out there called John Brown. I don't know who to, let's assign somebody to check him out. So if they come knocking on your door, you know they're trying to find it. You just tell them John Brown lives and slam the door. Frederick Douglass, who was a friend of John Brown, had a way with words equaled by few. We've had some great poets in our country and been fortunate to have been blessed by them. Thomas Jefferson and his magnificent words, Abraham Lincoln and his magnificent words, and Frederick Douglass and his magnificent words. And some of those words we would like to share with you tonight. John Brown and his friend joined together in the magnificent struggle, and John leaving and his friend being left behind and having occasion some later years to express the meaning of John Brown to himself and to the rest of the world. A speech he made in 1881. And this is a part of that speech. Not to fan the flame of sectional animosity, now happily in the process of rapid and, I hope, permanent extinction. Not to revive and keep alive a sense of shame and remorse for a great national crime, which has brought its own punishment and loss of treasure, tears, and blood, not to recount the long list of wrongs inflicted on my race during more than 200 years of merciless bondage, nor yet to draw from the labyrinths of far-off centuries incidents and achievements wherewith to rouse your passions and enkindle your enthusiasm, but to pay a just debt long due, to vindicate in some degree a great historical character of our own time and country, one with whom I was myself well acquainted and whose friendship and confidence it was my good fortune to share, and to give you such recollections, impressions, and facts as I can of a grand, brave, and good old man, and especially to promote a better understanding of the raid upon Harper's Ferry, of which he was the chief, is the object of this address. On the night of the 16th of October, 1859, there appeared near the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah rivers a party of 19 men, 14 white and 5 colored. They were not only armed themselves, but had brought with them a large supply of arms for such persons as might join them. These men invaded Harper's Ferry, disarmed the watchmen, took possession of the arsenal, rifle factory, armory, and other government property at that place, arrested and made prisoners nearly all the prominent citizens of the neighborhood, collected about 50 slaves, put bayonets into the hands of such as were able and willing to fight for their liberty, killed 3 men, proclaimed general emancipation, held the ground more than 30 hours, and was subsequently overpowered and nearly all killed, wounded, or captured by a body of United States troops under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee, since famous as the Rebel General Lee. 3 out of the 19 invaders were captured while fighting, and one of these was Captain John Brown, the man who originated, planned, and commanded the expedition. At the time of his capture, Captain Brown was supposed to be mortally wounded, as he had severely been ugly, had severe ugly gashes and bayonet wounds on his head and body. And apprehending that he might speedily die, or that he might be rescued by his friends, and thus the opportunity of making him a signal example of slaveholding vengeance would be lost, his captors hurried him to Charlestown, 2 miles further within the border of Virginia, placed him in prison strongly guarded by troops, and before his wounds were healed, he was brought into court, subjected to a nominal trial, convicted of high treason and inciting slaves to insurrection, and was executed. His corpse was given to his woe-stricken widow, and she, assisted by anti-slavery friends, caused it to be borne to North Elba, Essex County, New York, and there his dust now reposes amid the silent, solemn, and snowy grandeur of the Adirondacks. Viewed apart and alone as a transaction separate and distinct from its antecedents and bearings, the raid takes rank with the most cold-blooded and atrocious wrongs ever perpetrated. But just here is the trouble. This raid on Harper's Ferry, no more than Sherman's March to the Sea, can consent to be viewed alone. To the broad vision of a true philosophy, nothing in this world stands alone. Everything is a necessary part of everything else. Every seed bears fruit after its kind, and nothing is reaped which is not sowed. The distance between seed time and harvest in the moral world may not be quite so well defined or as clearly intelligible as in the physical, yet the harvest nevertheless will surely come. And as in the physical world there are century plants, so it may be in the moral world, and their fruitage is as certain in the one as in the other. The bloody harvest of Harper's Ferry was ripened by the heat and moisture of merciless bondage of more than 200 years. That startling cry of alarm on the bank of the Potomac was but the answering back of the avenging angel to the midnight invasions of Christian slave traders on the sleeping hamlets of Africa. Viewed thus broadly, our subject is worthy of thoughtful and dispassionate consideration. It invites the study of the poet, scholar, philosopher, and statesman. But I can invite you to no such profound discussions. I am not the man, nor is this the occasion for such philosophical inquiry. Mine is the word of grateful memory to an old friend to tell you what I knew of him, what I knew of his inner life, of what he did and what he attempted, and thus, if possible, to make the mainspring of his actions manifest and thereby give you a clearer view of his character and services. It is said that next in value to the performance of great deeds ourselves is the capacity to appreciate such when performed by others. To more than this, I do not presume. Allow me one other personal word before I proceed. In the minds of some of the American people, I was myself credited with an important agency in the John Brown raid. Governor Henry A. Wise was manifestly of that opinion. He was at pains to have Mr. Buchanan send his marshals to Rochester to invite me to accompany them to Virginia. Fortunately, I left town several hours previous to their arrival. Much has been said of John Brown, much that is wise and beautiful, but in looking over what may be called John Brown literature, I have been little assisted with material and even less encouraged in any hope of access and success in treating the subject. However, despite the hold which slavery had in time on the country, despite the popular prejudice against the Negro, despite the shock which the first alarm occasioned, almost from the first, John Brown received a large measure of sympathy and appreciation. New England recognized in him the spirit which brought the Pilgrim to Plymouth and hailed him as a martyr and a saint. True, he had broken the law. True, he had struck for a despised people. True, he had crept upon his foe stealthily like a wolf upon the fold, and had dealt his blow in the dark while his enemy slept. But with all this and more to disturb the moral sense, men discerned in him the greatest and best qualities known to human nature and pronounced him good. Many consented to his death, then went home and taught their children to sing his praise as one whose soul is marching on through the realms of endless bliss. One element in explanation of this somewhat anomalous circumstance will probably be found in the troubled times which immediately succeeded. For when judgments are abroad in the world, men learn righteousness. The country had before this learned the value of Brown's heroic character. He had shown boundless courage and skill in dealing with the enemies of liberty in Kansas. With men so few and means so small and odds against them so great, no captain ever surpassed him in achievement, some of which seem almost beyond belief. With only 8 men in that bitter war, he met, fought, and captured Henry Clay Pate with 25 well-armed and mounted men. In this memorable encounter, he selected his ground so wisely, handled his men so skillfully, and attacked the enemy so vigorously that they could neither run nor fight, and were therefore compelled to surrender to a force less than one-third their own. With just 30 men, on another important occasion, during the same border war, he met and vanquished 400 Missourians under the command of General Reed. These men had come into the territory under an oath never to return to their homes till they had stamped out the last vestige of free state spirit in Kansas. But a brush with old Brown took their high conceit out of them, and they were glad to get off upon any terms without stopping to stipulate. With less than 100 men to defend the town of Lawrence, He ordered Offa to lead them and give battle to 1,400 men on the banks of the Waukerusia River, and was much vexed when his office was refused by General Jim Lane and others to whom the defense of the town was confided. Before leaving Kansas, he went into the border of Missouri and liberated a dozen slaves in a single night. And in spite of slave laws and marshals, he brought these people through half a dozen states and landed them safely in Canada. With 18 men, this man shook the whole social fabric of Virginia. With 18 men, he overpowered a town of nearly 3,000 souls. With these 18 men, he held that large community firmly in his grasp for 30 long hours. With these 18 men, he rallied in a single night 50 slaves to his standard and made prisoners of an equal number of the slave-holding class. With these 18 men, he defied the power and bravery of a dozen of the best militia companies that Virginia could send against him. Now, when slavery struck, as it certainly did strike, at the life of the country, it was not the fault of John Brown that our rulers did not at first know how to deal with it. He had already shown us the weak side of the rebellion, had shown us where to strike and how. It was not from lack of native courage that Virginia submitted for 30 long hours and at last was relieved only by federal troops, but because the attack was made on the side of her conscience and thus armed her against herself. When John Brown proclaimed emancipation to the slaves of Maryland and Virginia, he added to his war power the force of a moral earthquake. Virginia felt all her strong rib mountains to shake under the heavy tread of armed insurgents. Of his army of 19, her conscience made an army of 1,900. Another feature of the times worthy of notice was the effect of this blow upon the country at large. At the first moment, we were stunned and bewildered. Slavery had so benumbed the moral nation, sense of the nation, that it never suspected the possibility of an explosion like this. And it was difficult for Captain Brown to get himself taken for what he really was. Few could seem to comprehend that freedom to the slaves was his only object. If you will go back with me to that time, you will find that the most curious and contradictory versions of the affair were industriously circulated, and those which were the best, least rational and true seemed to command the readiest belief. In the view of some, it was assumed, it had assumed a tremendous proportion. To such, it was nothing less than a wide sweeping rebellion to overthrow the existing government and construct another upon its ruins, with Brown for its president and commander-in-chief. The proof of this was found in the old man's carpet bag in the shape of a constitution for a new republic, an instrument which, in reality, had been executed to govern the conduct of his men in the mountains. Smaller and meaner natures saw in it nothing higher than a purpose to plunder. To them, John Brown and his men were a gang of desperate robbers who had learned by some means that government had sent a large sum of money to Harper's Ferry to pay off the workmen in its employ there, and they had gone thence to fill their pockets with this money. The fact is that outside of a few friends scattered in different parts of the country and the slaveholders of Virginia, few persons understood the significance of the hour. that a man might do something very audacious and desperate for money, power, or fame was, to the general apprehension, quite possible. But in face of plainly written law, in face of constitutional guarantees protecting each state against domestic violence, in face of a nation of 40 million people, that 19 men could invade a great state to liberate a despised and hated race was to the average intellect and conscience too monstrous for belief. In this respect, the vision of Virginia was clearer than that of the nation. Conscious of her guilt and therefore full of suspicion, sleeping on pistols for pillows, startled at every unusual sound, constantly fearing and expecting a repetition of the Nat Turner insurrection, she at once understood the meaning, if not the magnitude, of the affair. It was this understanding which caused her to raise the hasty and imploring cry to the federal government for help, and it was not till he who struck the blow had fully explained his motives and objects that the incredulous nation in any wise comprehended the true spirit of the raid or of its commander. Fortunate for his memory, fortunate for the brave man associated with him, fortunate for the truth of history, John Brown survived the saber gashes, bayonet wounds, and bullet holes, and was able, though covered with blood, to tell his own story and make his own defense. Had he, with all his men, as might have been the case, gone down in the shock of battle, the world would have no true basis for its judgment in one of the most heroic efforts ever witnessed in behalf of liberty would have been confounded with base and selfish purposes. When, like savages, the Wises, the Vallandighams, the Washingtons, the Stuarts, and there stood around the fallen and bleeding hero and sought by torturing questions to wring from his supposed dying lips some words by which to soil the sublime undertaking by implicating Gerrit Smith, Joshua R. Giddings, Dr. S.G. Howe, G.L. Stearns, Edwin Morton, Frank Sanborn, and other prominent anti-slavery men, the brave old man not only avowed his object to be the emancipation of the slaves, but severely and proudly announced himself as the solely responsible for all that had happened. Though some thought of his own life might at such moment have seemed natural and excusable, he showed none and scornfully rejected the idea that he acted as an agent or an instrument of any man or set of men. He admitted that he had friends and sympathizers, but to his own head he invited all the bolts of slaveholding wrath and fury and welcomed them to do their worst. His manly courage and self-forgetful nobleness were not lost upon the crowd about him, nor upon the country. They drew applause from his bitterest enemies. Said Henry A. Wise, "He is the gamest man I ever met." He was kind and humane to his prisoners, said Colonel Lewis Washington. To the outward eye of men, John Brown was a criminal, but to their inward eye, he was a just man and true. His deeds might be disowned, but the spirit which made those deeds possible was worthy of the highest honor. It's been often asked, why did not Virginia spare the life of this man? Why did she not avail herself of this grand opportunity to add to her other glory, that of a lofty magnanimity? Had they spared the good old man's life? Had they said to him, you see, we have you in our power and could easily take your life, but we have no desire to hurt you in any way. You have committed a terrible crime against society. You have invaded us at midnight and attacked a sleeping community, but we recognize you as a lunatic, as a fanatic, and in some sense instigated by others. And on this ground and others, we release you. Go about your business and tell those who sent you that we can afford to be magnanimous to our enemies. I say, had Virginia held some such language as this to Brown, they would have inflicted a heavy blow on the whole Northern abolition movement, one which only the omnipotence of truth and the force of truth could have overcome. I have no doubt Governor Wise would have done so gladly, but alas, he was the executive of a state which thought she could not afford such magnanimity. She had that within her bosom which could more safely tolerate the presence of a criminal than a saint, a highway robber than a moral hero. All her hills and valleys were studded with material for a disastrous conflagration. And one spark of the dauntless spirit of Brown might set the whole state in flames. A sense of this appalling liability put an end to every noble consideration. His death was a foregone conclusion, and his trial was simply one of them. Honor to the brave young Colonel Hoyt, who hastened from Massachusetts to defend his friend's life at the peril of his own. But there would have been no hope of success had he been allowed to plead the case. He might have surpassed Choate or Webster in power. 1,000 physicians might have sworn that Captain Brown was insane. It would have been all to no purpose. Neither eloquence nor testimony could have prevailed. Slavery was the idol of Virginia, and pardon and life to Brown meant condemnation and death to slavery. He had practically illustrated a truth stranger than fiction, a truth higher than Virginia had ever known, a truth more noble and beautiful than Jefferson ever wrote. He had evinced a conception of the sacredness and value of liberty which transcended in sublimity that of her own Patrick Henry, and made even his fire-flashing sentiments of liberty or death seem dark and tame and selfish. Henry loved liberty for himself, but this man loved liberty for all men, and for those most despised and scorned, as well as for those most esteemed and honored. Just here was the true glory of John Brown's mission. It was not for his own freedom that he was thus ready to lay down his life. For with Paul he could say, I was born free. No chain had bound his ankle. No yoke had galled his neck. History has no better illustration of pure, disinterested benevolence. It was not Caucasian for Caucasian, white man for white, not rich man for rich man, but Caucasian for Ethiopian, white man for black man, rich man for poor man. The man admitted and respected for the man despised and rejected. I want you to understand, gentlemen, he said to his persecutors, that I respect the rights of the poorest and weakest of the colored people oppressed by the slave system as I do those of the most wealthy and powerful. In this, we have the key to the whole life and career of the man. With the Allegheny Mountains for his pulpit, the country for his church, and the whole civilized world for his audience, he was 1,000 times more effective as a preacher than as a warrior. And the consciousness of this fact was the secret of his amazing complacency. Might with the sword of steel, he was mightier with the sword of truth. And with this sword, he literally swept the horizon. He was more than a match for all the wisest masons, Vallandighams in Washington who could rise against him. They could kill him, but they could not answer him. Most of us can remember some event or incident which at some time has come to us and made itself a permanent part of our lives. Such an incident came to me in the year 1847. I had then the honor of spending a day and night under the roof of a man whose character and conversation made a very deep impression on my mind and heart. And as the circumstance does not lie entirely out of our present observations, you will pardon for a moment a seeming digression. The name of the person alluded to had been several times mentioned to me in a tone that made me curious to see him and make his acquaintance. He was a merchant, and our first meeting was at his store, a substantial brick building giving evidence of a flourishing business. After a few minutes' detention, long enough for me to observe the neatness and order of the place, I was conducted by him to his residence, where I was kindly received by his family as an expected guest. I was a little disappointed at the appearance of this man's house, for after seeing his fine store, I was prepared to see a fine residence. But this logic was entirely contradicted by the facts. The house was a small wooden one on a black street in a neighborhood of laboring men and mechanics, respectful enough, but not just the spot where one would expect to find the home of a successful merchant. Plain as was the outside, the inside was plainer. Its furniture might have pleased a Spartan. It would take longer to tell what was not in it than what was. No sofas, no cushions, no curtains, no carpets, no easy rocking chairs invited to innovation of rest or repose. My first meal passed under the misnomer of tea. It was none of your tea and toast sort, but potatoes and cabbage and beef soup. Such a meal as a man might relish after following the plow all day, or after performing a forced march of 12 miles over rough ground in frosty weather. Innocent of paint, veneering, varnish, a tablecloth, the table announced itself unmistakably and honestly pine and of the plainest workmanship. No hired help passed from kitchen to dining room, serving, starting in amazement at the colored man at the white man's table. The mother, daughters, and son did the serving and did it well. I heard no apology for doing their own work. They went through it as if used to it, untouched by any thought of degradation or impropriety. Supper over, the boys helped to clear the table and wash the dishes. This style of housekeeping struck me as a little odd. Such a man, whose name I heard uttered in whispers, such was the house in which he lived. Such were family and household management, and such was Captain John Brown. He said to me at this meeting that he had invited me to his house for the special purpose of laying before me his plan for the speedy emancipation of my race. He seemed to apprehend opposition on my part as he opened the subject and touched my vanity by saying that he had observed my course at home and abroad and wanted my cooperation. He said he had been here for the last 30 years looking for colored men to whom he could safely reveal his secret and had almost despaired at times of finding such, but that now he was encouraged, for he saw heads rising up in all directions to whom he thought he could safely impart his plan. As this plan then lay in his mind, it was very simple and had much to commend it. It did not, as was supposed by many, contemplate a general rising among the slaves and a general slaughter of the slave masters for insurrection. Insurrection, he thought, would only defeat the object. But it did contemplate the creating of an armed force which should act in the very heart of the South. He was not averse to the shedding of blood and thought the practice of carrying arms would be a good one for the colored people to adopt, as it would give them a sense of manhood. No people, he said, could have self-respect or be respected who would not fight for their freedom. He called my attention to a large map of the United States and pointed out to me the far-reaching Alleghenies stretching away from the borders of New York into the southern states. These mountains, he said, are the heart and basis of my plan. God has given the strength of these hills to freedom. They were placed here to aid the emancipation of your race. They are full of natural forts where one man for defense would be equal to 100 for attack. They're full of good hiding places where a large number of men could be concealed and baffle and elude pursuit for a long time. I know these mountains well and could take a body of men into them and keep them there in spite of all the efforts of Virginia to dislodge me and drive me out. The trouble was to get the right men to start with and money enough to equip them. He had adopted the simple and economic mode of living to which I have referred with the view to save money for this purpose. This was said in no boastful tone, for he felt that he had delayed already too long and had no room to boast either his zeal or his self-denial. From 8 o'clock in the evening to 3 a.m. in the morning, Captain Brown and I sat face to face, he arguing in favor of his plan and I finding all the objections I could argue against it. Now mark, this meeting of ours was a full 12 years before the strike at Harper's Ferry. He had been watching and waiting all that time for suitable heads to rise and pop up, as he said, among the sable millions in whom he could confide. Hence, 40 years had passed between his thought and his act. 2 weeks prior to the meditated attack, Captain Brown summoned me to meet him at an old stone quarry at the river near the town of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. His arms and ammunition were stored in that town and were to be moved on to Harper's Ferry. In company with Shields Green, I obeyed the summons, and prompt to the hour we met the dear old man with Kagi, his secretary, the appointed place. Our meeting was in some sense a council of war. We spent the Saturday and succeeding Sunday in conference on the question whether the desperate step should be taken, or the old plan, as already described, should be carried out. He was for boldly striking Harper's Ferry at once and running the risk of getting into the mountains afterwards. I was for avoiding Harper's Ferry altogether. Shields Green and Mr. Coggy remained silent, listeners throughout. It is needless to repeat here what was said after what had happened. Suffice it that after all I could say, I saw that my old friend had resolved on his course, and it was idle to parley. I told him finally that it was impossible for me to join him. I could see Harper's Ferry only as a trap of steel, and ourselves on the wrong side of it. He regretted my decision, and we parted. If a monument should be erected to the memory of John Brown, as there ought to be, the form and name of Shields Green should have a conspicuous place upon it. It is a remarkable fact that in this small company of men, one alone showed any sign of weakness or regret for what he did or attempted to do. Poor Cook broke down and sought to save his life by representing that he had been deceived and allured by false promises. But Stevens, Hazlitt, and Green went to their doom like the heroes they were, without a murmur, without a regret, believing alike in their captain and in their cause. For the disastrous termination of this invasion, several causes have been assigned. It has been said that Captain Brown found it necessary to strike before he was ready, that men had promised to join him from the north who failed to arrive, that the cowardly Negroes did not rally to his support as he expected, but the true cause, as stated by himself, contradicts all these theories, and from his statement, there is no appeal. Among the questions put to him by Mr. Van Landingham after his capture was the following: did you expect a general uprising of the slaves in case of your success? To this he answered, no, sir, nor did I wish it. I expected to gather enough from time to time and then to set them free. Did you expect to hold possession here until then? Answer, well, probably I had quite a different idea. I do not know as I ought to reveal my plan. I am here, wounded and a prisoner, because I foolishly permitted myself to be so. You overstate your strength when you suppose I could have taken if I had allowed it. I could have been taken if I had allowed it. I was too tardy after commencing the opening attack and delaying any movements through Monday night and up to the time of the arrival of the government troops. It was all because of my desire to spare the feelings of my prisoners and their families. But the question is, did John Brown fail? He certainly did fail to get out of Harper's Ferry before being beaten down by the United States soldiers. He did fail to save his own life and to lead a liberating army into the mountains of Virginia. But did he not go to Harper's Ferry to save his life? But he did not go to Harper's Ferry to save his life. The true question is, did John Brown draw his sword against slavery and thereby lose his life in vain? And to this I answer 10,000 times, no. No man fails or can fail who so grandly gives himself and all he has to a righteous cause. No man who in his hour of extremest need went on his way to meet an ignominious death could so forget himself as to stop and kiss a little child, one of the hated race for whom he was about to die, could by any possibility fail. Did John Brown fail? Ask Henry A. Wise, in whose house less than 2 years after a school for the emancipated slaves was taught. Did John Brown fail? Ask James M. Mason, the author of the inhuman fugitive slave bill, who was cooped up in Fort Warren as a traitor less than 2 years from the time that he stood over the prostrate body of John Brown. Did John Brown fail? Ask Clemming C. Vallandigham, one other of the inquisitorial party, for he too went down to the tremendous whirlpool created by the powerful hand of this bold invader. If John Brown did not end the war that ended slavery, he did at least begin the war that ended slavery. If we look over the dates, places, and men for whom this honor is claimed, we shall find that not Carolina, but Virginia, not Fort Sumter, but Harper's Ferry in the arsenal, not Colonel Anderson, but John Brown began the war that ended American slavery and made this a free republic. Until this blow was struck, the prospect for freedom was dim, shadowy, and uncertain. The irrepressible conflict was one of words, votes, and compromises. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared. The time for compromises was gone. The hosts of freedom, armed, stood face to face over the chasm of a broken Union, and the clash of arms was at hand. The South staked all upon getting possession of the federal government, and failing to do that, drew the sword of rebellion, and thus made her own, and not Brown's, the best cause, the lost cause of the century. The lost cause of the century.